The spiritual community, on the other hand, belongs to the higher evolution. It's not a collectivity. It's a community of individuals. Now, a spiritual community is not only not a group, but it is not a substitute for a group either. What does this mean? As I said some weeks ago, we are living in times of transition. Many things are changing. Many old established institutions and customs and traditions are breaking up. And this applies to many of the old established groups. Many of them are breaking up. All kinds of groups are breaking up. For instance, the family in some areas is, I won't say breaking up, but beginning to break up. Certainly, family ties are not nearly so important, not nearly so significant as they used to be. I mean, nowadays, who bothers to keep up connections with his second and third cousins? Well, you hardly know who they are nowadays, but formerly, you kept track of every single person, even remotely related to you. This is still very much the case in the East. I remember very, very often I'd meet somebody and he'd introduce me to somebody else and say, he's a close relation of mine. He's my brother. Oh, I'd say, after a bit, knowing the situation, same mother, same father? Oh, no. He is my great-great-grandfather's second son's third daughter's wife's sister's son's husband's father's sister's wife. That's the relationship. And this is how they'd say, just straight off like that. And they kept up the knowledge, they kept up the connection with every single relation that they had, sometimes even a couple of hundred of them. But we don't do that, certainly in the West, or in most parts of the West, anymore. Family ties are not so strong as they used to be. The family, to some extent, is breaking up. Again, many people nowadays leave the country of their birth. This used to happen very rarely. Lots of people in the old days lived without ever moving out of their own village. In the Tao Te Ching, this is held up as an ideal, that throughout your whole life, you hear the sounds of the next village, but you never actually go there. Well, very few people are in that situation nowadays. Maybe a few people living in the Outer Hebrides and places like that. But most people have been places, as they say. And lots of people, again, have left their own country and settled in some foreign land. And not only settled in some foreign land, but had to speak a foreign language. Some, of course, have come as refugees of various kinds. Some even have come because their original countries have been broken up and incorporated in some other country. Others, of course, come as students. Others come for reasons of business. And others, of course, just come. And again, of course, classes are much more fluid than they used to be. In the old days, the good old days, if you were born a serf, well, a serf you remained. You lived and died a serf. And if you were born a nobleman, well, that's what you were all through your life. And you died a nobleman, even if you died on the scaffold. But at least you died like a nobleman. You had special privileges, and you could have your head cut off while you were wearing a velvet cloak, which wasn't permitted to a commoner. And that's a great consolation to you. But nowadays, everything is much more fluid. Nowadays, classes are much more variable. You can move up, you can move down. Or at least you can move up. People wouldn't admit, perhaps, to moving down. But certainly you can move up within the social system. You can subtly and quietly and gently, especially if you move to another part of the country and change your accent, you can move up as regards class, and so on. And it also happens, of course, that nowadays we often lose touch with our old friends and the people we went to school with, and so on. And the net result of all this is this loosening of family ties, these movements from one country to another, this shift within the social system, moving up maybe to a different class. The result is that quite a number of people find themselves eventually rather on their own. There's no particular group to which they belong. Suppose you've no family. Suppose you're living in a foreign country, speaking a foreign language, and you've also changed your class. Well, what sort of group have you got that you belong to? very often no group at all. So you're just on your own. So how do these people feel? Well, of course, they feel very lonely. They feel rather cut off. They feel pretty isolated. So what do they do? I mean, quite naturally, even unconsciously, they start looking around for a group. Start looking around for a group to which they can belong. Nice people with whom they can mix, among whom they can settle down. So looking in this way, searching in this way, trying to overcome their own loneliness and isolation, they come in contact perhaps with a spiritual community. In other words, they come in contact with a number of individuals who are trying to develop themselves. So they go along, they meet them, they feel there's maybe a lot of friendliness around, there's a good atmosphere, everything seems very positive. So they decide to join. They decide that they too want to belong. But what is happening? They are not joining it as a spiritual community, they're joining it as a group. They're not joining it in order to develop. They're joining it for the sake of warmth. Joining it for the sake of togetherness. Joining it for the sake of companionship. Joining it perhaps because they just can't face any longer the four walls of their cold bedsitter. And in this way, in this sort of way, the spiritual community becomes a substitute for the group. It becomes a substitute for a family. You haven't got a family? All right, you join the spiritual community. Don't belong to any club? All right, you join the spiritual community. You don't even belong to a tribe? Haven't got a chief of your own? All right, you join the spiritual community. Haven't got a totem of your own? You join the spiritual community. Now, in this connection, it's very interesting to look at certain developments in modern Japan. In modern Japan, what do we find? We find a very interesting thing happen. Nowadays in the West, and in this country too, you find all sorts of good ecclesiastical people complaining that no one's interested in religion anymore. I mean, they tell you quite frankly that if only you could get everybody into a church, even if you had to shut the doors on them and sort of keep them there, everything would be all right, there'd be peace in the world. Everything would be lovely. But no one seems to be interested in this simple remedy. Everybody seems to ignore it. And these good people tell us, well, what we want is a religious revival. You know, we've got to bring religion back, the ages of faith and all that. And then we'll solve all these problems that we're confronted by. But no one listens. People turn a deaf ear. But in Japan, it's not like that. They've not had just a religious revival. You find in Japan, since the war, lots of new sects have sprung up, even lots of new religions. I mean, they've even gone better than what people want us to go in this country. They've not had just a religious revival, but all sorts of new sects and even new religions have been founded. And I gather, after reading a few books on the subject, that there are several hundreds of these all over Japan. New sects, new religions are mushrooming. You get a new one almost every week, apparently. The teaching of all these new sects and new religions is mainly Buddhist. It mainly draws upon the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, General Mahayana Buddhism, Nichiren sect, and so on. But the teaching apparently doesn't matter. That's not the most important thing. What matters in all these sects, in all these new religions, is the organization. Each of these sects, each of these new religions has, of course, a founder. And one finds that the founder nearly always takes the title of either patriarch or archbishop. This is what they usually call themselves. And everyone calls the founder, I mean, including the press, well, the venerable patriarch of such and such sect or the venerable archbishop of such and such new religion. And the founder, whether patriarch or archbishop, usually has a wife. And these two form the heads of the new sect or the new religion. In other words, they're the archetypal father and mother. And sometimes they're even called father and mother by their followers. And then there are tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands, in a few cases even millions, of devoted followers, all rushing to join these new sects and new religions. Some of them even going to parliament. Now, there are many grades. They've got a real hierarchy worked out. Some have got 10, 12, 14 different grades of membership and promotion. And they've all got their distinctive robes, distinctive uniforms, badges, sashes, headgear, all very, very colourful indeed, in the way the Japanese can do these things. And then they've got palatial buildings. They've got temples and archbishops' palaces, and some of them have got their own stores, and some have got even their own railway stations and all sorts of things like that. And then they have mass meetings and mass rallies in great stadiums, and semi-military processions and parades through the streets of the town with banners and slogans and music and chanting and everybody doing exactly the same thing at the same time. Now, why do they have all this? Why this development? What is happening? What is going on? Clearly, the Japanese, the modern Japanese, want, even desperately need, something that they can belong to. They want, or they need, psychologically, something to replace the old feudal clan. Over the last 100 years, the feudal clan has disintegrated. And that was the center, in the old days in Japan, of one's loyalty. The feudal clan and the head of the feudal clan. But after the Meiji Restoration and so on, modernization, industrialization of Japan, all that was swept away. So the ordinary, average Japanese was left, as it were, in mid-air, without anything to belong to, anything to be loyal to, anything to be devoted to, anything to commit harakiri for. What a terrible state of affairs. The family was too small, even the Japanese family. It was too small to be a focus of loyalty. The country as a whole, Japan, the land of the rising sun, that was too big. In any case, nationalism was a Western concept, maybe foreign to the Japanese mind. The Japanese needed something in between, something much bigger than the family, but not nearly so big as the state, as the nation. Many Japanese, of course, adopted, as it were, the business firm for which they worked. For many Japanese, the business firm that employs you becomes your group. We don't realize sometimes in this country how this is in Japan in this respect. You join when you're very young, as a junior, and you never leave. In this country, any self-respecting young man of 21 has had at least 20 jobs. I worked for 20 different employers, public and private, but not in Japan. You join when you are young. Very often you join your father's firm, and you never leave. You live in a house belonging to your firm. You're married under the auspices of your firm. You go on holidays organized by the firm with fellow employees. And you regard the chairman of the firm, the president of the board, or the company, or the corporation, as your sort of super father. And you really look up to him with reverence and regard, and you'd really give your life for him. So this is what many Japanese do. The firm becomes their group. Others join one or another of the new sects and the new religions. This is how deep the hunger to belong to a group goes. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong to want to belong to a group, whether or not there's a group instinct. We might say it's a natural human, or rather natural animal, need. But I'm only saying that the spiritual community is not a group. And since it's not a group, it should not be used as a substitute for a group.